Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, I think that when I look back on the year 2020, for the rest of my life, I will have to say that it's shaping up to be one of the most memorable years in my lifetime. And let's all take a deep cleansing breath. You know, deep breathing lowers your blood pressure. We'll have some emails later on about the autonomic nervous system and why it's so important to keep that balanced. But let's just take a slow, deep breath in. And now we'll move on to the real existential crisis, which, as they used to say in Saturday Night Live, this just in. The Danish government will slaughter millions of minks at more than 1,000 farms, citing concerns over a mutation in the novel coronavirus that has infected the mink and could possibly interfere with the effectiveness of a vaccine in humans. So we're going to go back just a little bit in the Wayback Machine, just a few months to June 17th, when the first cases on a mink farm, by the way, Denmark makes most of the world's minks. It's a big deal. It's a major industry for them. And on June 17th, the first cases of minks with coronavirus were reported at a farm. And they thought, well, they caught them from humans. There were humans who also had coronavirus. And that was the first report. And there were several more over the summer. The sixth farm by September 2nd, and by then, it sort of went national. I believe that somewhere in there it got reported. The U.S. Department of Agriculture noted it, ironically, on September 11th, 2020, and said, yeah, this is kind of going on, but they're isolating the farms, and stay tuned for more developments. Well, today, the more developments just happened. There are 12 humans in the Jutland region who are known to have this variant coronavirus. And unfortunately, samples of the virus show a weak reaction to the antibodies, the Regeneron antibody batch, for example, and to human antibodies to COVID-19. That's all we know. They have not released the sequence of the virus. No one really knows anything more except that there are some genetic changes. That's all the World Health Organization would say. They said they are investigating it and culling the mink population. Stay tuned. So basically, we don't really know. In September, there was a report, which has not been peer-reviewed, that the virus was jumping between minks and humans. And in Denmark, the government is saying, yeah, from minks to humans. Now, I want to talk about ferrets. Minks are basically a very soft and fuzzy ferret. And ferrets have a really interesting propensity to pass viruses to humans. In fact, and this is going back, gosh, it's got to be easily 5 years, and you will find it if you dredge around and search, but in, let's call it 5+ years ago, some experimenters decided to take some samples of the old H1N1 flu virus that had been dug up from some frozen people in Antarctica somewhere, I think. I'm not really sure exactly where the frozen people were, but they died of H1N1, so they were able to get the sequence of the virus and build it. I'm not entirely sure that was a bright idea, but there you go. Somebody decided to see if they could make it respiratory. So they, instead of droplets, you know, tiny little particles, so they passed it from ferrets, you know, By the fifth generation, the virus had mutated such that it could pass respiratory. This is not a really good thing, and it would. And the concern was, gee, if you can make that flu go into ferrets, maybe you could. Maybe we really don't want to be playing around with this. And indeed, I didn't think at the time that they should be. But we're talking about evolution. By the way, if you have a pet ferret and you get COVID, I would caution you to isolate your ferret and not let your friends pet your ferret. Maybe even you shouldn't pet your ferret yourself unless you and your ferret are completely in lockdown together. Just saying. And this is kind of an important thing. Other news on the COVID front is we're going to talk a little bit about evolution. I want to stop before we go any further and just remind you of something that happened in 2009, which was another H1N1 outbreak. And at the time, the initial cases were primarily in Mexico, and they were very severe. They looked a lot like the old reports of the 1918 flu. We've all been hearing a little bit about that this year. And the people who got sickest were the youngest people with the strongest immune systems, which is interesting. And of course, military recruits were on the move, it being 1918. So there was a lot of vectoring going on. When it came up again in 2009, there were concerns because this looked a lot alike. The government of Mexico did something really smart and really good. They shut down the airports. I believe it was for about 48 hours. They closed the borders, and you couldn't get out of Mexico. And by then, the people who had this really severe, rapidly, makes you really sick, really fast version of the H1N1 were really sick and didn't try to leave the country. People who had an already mutated, milder version of this virus did, and we did have an outbreak. It was not severe, but it was very scary. And, you know, like Yogi Berra said, when this thing came along, it was deja vu all over again. But viruses mutate quickly, particularly flu. And you have to stop and think about what are the evolutionary pressures here. We're going to talk about evolutionary pressure for a second. What does a virus want to do? It wants to reproduce. How does it do that? By infecting as many people as possible and not killing them. If it infects them really slowly, like, for example, they can be incubating before they get symptoms. Coronavirus, check. If it doesn't make them really sick most of the time so that they can walk around and spread it, that's also really good. What we saw in 2009 is we saw natural experiment where the only people who could get out of Mexico with the virus were the ones who had the kinder, gentler version of that particular H1N1 virus. And they did, but it was the kinder, gentler version, so it didn't set off another 1918. We need to draw lessons from this. We need to understand that we're going to need to use all of our smarts and all of our technologies because This is not going to be our last rodeo. As long as we are a global culture, we're going to have problems with things moving. I mean, bubonic plague moved on sailing ships, for goodness sakes. Anytime you can travel, and you can travel passively, you're going to have hitchhikers along for the ride. So one study I wanted to tell you about was just a quick one that was done in Houston. Again, about viral evolution, if you will. And they were looking at people who had COVID, and they looked at the virus strains present in every zip code in Houston. What they found was a shift of the virus, 71% of it in the initial pandemic. In the so-called second wave that hit Houston this summer, this variant had leaped to 99.9%. And this is the variant that came to the United States from Europe, and it got a head start. So maybe it's not more contagious. Maybe it just had a founder effect, and we really don't know that. And so it's very, very important not to jump to conclusions about increased infectivity when you talk about this virus. There are other things at work here. Now, on the positive front, there's a paper that was published a couple days ago, yesterday, in fact, and it talks about using an algorithm, not for contact tracing, but for contact targeting. So let me explain. Sewage. When people are infected with COVID, they often shed the virus in their poop. We'll be coming to an email in a little bit of time, and so I want to emphasize that if people can poop it out, when you flush a toilet, if you can't close the lid, then you're going to aerosolize the virus. We know that happens with bacteria, and the virus is a good deal lighter than bacteria. In fact, viral traces of coronavirus can be detected in sewage up to a week before physical symptoms occur. So if we were able to monitor the sewage, we might be able to actually find hot pockets, outbreaks, even individuals who were shedding virus before it spread to the greater community. So using that as a premise, Dr. Richard Larson and Dr. Odit Berman, and I'm going to mess this one up, Mehdi Norinjad of York University put together two algorithms, and the one I'm most interested in, because of where we are, is for a community that has very few infections. And the second is for a community known to have many infections. The first algorithm is designed to respond when wastewater at a treatment plant has just revealed traces of the infection, indicating a new infection in the community. The algorithm will actually identify the city block just by looking at the tree searching of what pipe did it come in on, and what's connected to those pipes. So you can essentially go from the branch, from the trunk, out to the branch and identify where you need to send people out and do basically contact testing. These are people who are near someone. One of them is the shedder, but other people need to be tested. And then you could do better quarantining, better isolation. MIT's been able to test wastewater on campus, and what they do is they sample from the sewage pipe that's coming out of each dormitory. Now, a dormitory could have dozens and dozens of people, but treatment plants serve thousands. So if you check the dorm, it's essentially doing a pooled sample of all of the people in that dorm, and if you get a positive, you immediately call the people in that dorm, stay home, we're coming through, we're testing you. And we'd be able to keep it from spreading from universities, who, while people are affected by the virus, generally don't get dead from it, to communities around universities, where that sort of thing is a real possibility. It's been said that finding newly infected people can be looking for a needle in a haystack, but this algorithm could really shrink the haystack. And I see it as something, as I said, we're going to have to be thinking about this sort of thing moving forward. So I see it as something that we do need to think about and that we can think about. So I'll have some more thoughts on the matter of evolution and evolutionary pressure, but we're going to tie those to the emails. So going to emails now, and we had a fair number of them this week. Thank you so much for the people who emailed with your questions. And there's some very interesting ones, I might add. First of all, I want to give a shout out to John and Tracy Holland in Seattle for the lovely gift that they sent me. They run a handbag company called Chemical Wedding. And I will just quote Tracy's note: your advice, community service, public source, health info, attentive detail to all of my emails regarding the health of me and my loved ones is appreciated gratefully, Tracy. So I'm not soliciting gifts here, but I definitely want to acknowledge the beautiful and very COVID-proof backpack that they sent me, which I'm sure to be styling this winter. It'll fit nicely over my coat and gloves. So thank you, Tracy. We go to our first email, and this is from Anna in Santa Cruz. Anna writes, mast cell activation. Please talk about mast cell activation. My doctor diagnosed me, and I've tried an elimination diet, various H1 and H2 antihistamines, and quercetin, but I don't feel any significant changes. So let's start with what the heck is a mast cell? And a mast cell is a type of cell that wanders around in your body. It likes to hang out on borders. So borders as in surfaces, walls. And we're talking skin and the linings of hollow organs. Mast cells are a normal component of tissue, and they carry a bunch of chemicals inside them. Leukotrienes, which are a chemical inflammatory signal, histamines, which are, well, allergies, right? Opens up the capillary beds and makes them leak. Prostaglandin, another inflammatory signal, and tryptase, which is a enzyme that dissolves proteins. There are really two problems with mast cell activation. There's mastocytosis, which is where people just have an increased number of mast cells, and but people who have the mast cell activation syndrome have a normal number, but they're hyper-responsive. In other words, they're more irritable. There's a host of symptoms you can get from this. Hives and angioedema, which is swelling of the tongue and lips, the sort of things that you might get if you have a bee sting allergy or a penicillin allergy and got some penicillin. It can be dangerous. Your skin can get, of course, hives. It can burn. You can be able to write your name in red on the person's skin with a blunt object like a tongue depressor. And lots and lots of itchiness. But they can also get dizzy. They can faint. They can have rapid heartbeat. They can have arrhythmias. Pretty dangerous. Diarrhea and cramping, very common. Intestinal difficulty, sometimes difficulty with throat tightness, and of course they can wheeze and sneeze. But primarily, these symptoms are very difficult, very common, and it's a bit difficult to diagnose. Sometimes we diagnose it by simply testing the blood for things like that elevated tryptase or certain prostaglandins or leukotrienes. And sometimes we get responses with mast cell stabilizers like cromolyn, your standard H1 antihistamines like fexafenidine, and that's Allegra, loratadine, Claritin, and, you know, even diphenhydramine, which is, you know, good old, like the basic antihistamine that we all know and love. Some of the H2 blockers, which are technically antacid drugs, but they also help in the skin. And drugs like monolucast and Zulotin work to prevent leukotrienes from being active. By the way, natural inhibitors include curcumin and St. John's wort extracts. So I have three suggestions for Anne, since she's tried the pharmaceuticals and she's on quercetin. Maybe she needs to go after those leukotrienes. So high doses of curcumin, which is the active component of turmeric, and also St. John's wort, both over the counter. And some people actually get helped by aspirin. So my suggestions to you, Anne, are do those things. And one more that also has very strong mast cell stabilization properties, and that is a bioflavonoid called luteolin. And the dose on that's about 100 milligrams. The dose on the curcumin should be at least 500 milligrams. And I'm sorry, off the top of my head, I can't tell you the dose of St. John's wort, but I would use the antidepressant dose, which is used by many people and is very safe. I sure hope that'll help you, Anne, and give us a call or an email and let us know how we do. We have a email. Hi, Dr. Dawn. Could you talk about the correlation between blood type and acquiring and living with COVID? I recently found my blood type is O positive. One clinical study of about 1,000 people found some differences in people with different blood types. Thank you. Take care. Ton ami qui parle français. Oh, Michael. Hello, Michael. I miss our Tuesday morning French meetups. God, those were fun. Zoom is great, but I'll tell you, there's nothing like the chatter of a crowd, and you don't get that on Zoom. Okay. Yes, people with blood type O may have the lowest risk of infection. Statistically, this seems to be the case. Not clear if it has to do with the COVID virus itself or the spike protein. The jury is still out on that, although I have seen the spike protein as a putative mechanism. Obviously, your blood type changes what HLA antigens or what essentially barcodes are being displayed on your body tissue. That's why you can't transplant a type A heart into a type B body and not expect a transplant rejection, or for that matter, blood. But of course, organ transplants got a lot more, let's say, barcodes that we have to deal with. Not clear why. It does seem to be a thing. Congratulations, Michael, that you have type O. I would not rely on this. Unfortunately, I was talking today to a local doctor who herself has had COVID, and she made a very strong point to me that, yeah, I had it. I don't want to get it again. And no one is really sure you get it again if you can get really sick. There is at least one reported case of someone with a documented first case, getting a documented second case, and getting very sick. So what does that mean? Stay tuned, as we keep saying, but do tune in every week to Ask Dr. Dawn, because I am really trying very hard to keep you updated. So our next email comes from Marionette in Watsonville, and the subject is povidone iodine inactivates SARS-CoV-2. Would like to hear your take on this. Is intranasal application of 0.5% povidone iodine after possible exposure to SARS-CoV-2 something lay people might benefit from? Any potential harm to doing it a couple of times a week, after shopping trips, for instance? It looks like in vivo studies haven't yet been completed, but health professionals are doing it. And does betadine expire? I've had a bottle of it for about 10 years now. Oh, and how to dilute the stuff in the bottle to achieve the right dilution? I would use my nasal irrigation bottle and rinse for 15 seconds in each nostril. Thank you for your generous sharing of your medical expertise with the public. So let's start with talking about the in vitro studies. There, I did actually find one, Marion, that showed that 0.5% iodine, as povidone iodine, would work. Before I dive into this, I do want to say I use colloidal silver. It's very non-toxic, and I've kept a little bit in my car, and I use that at the office, and it's very good at killing viruses and bacteria. Also extraordinarily safe. I could probably drink a liter of the stuff, and I just have a nice bluish cast to my skin, which maybe some Halloween I'll give a shot. Go as a superhero in. But for now, let's get back to your question. There is a study that showed that that would work. It takes about 15 seconds to inactivate the virus, so dwell time's not too bad. And you could potentially dilute regular iodine. I also found a paper in the American Journal of Otolaryngology, published in the September to October issue, that went over doing the testing. And they actually did this as a study amongst medical professionals and patients at an ear, nose, and throat clinic. Now, obviously, if you're looking in someone's nose or throat during the COVID epidemic, you'd like a little belt and suspenders protection beyond your PPE. And so the oropharynx and nasopharynx have a lot of copies. It's been shown that there are 1.2 times 10 to the 8th infective copies per ml. That's a lot of virus per milliliter of snot. And we know that asymptomatic people can shed. So this was done with, as I said, an outpatient department for ENT. And they used 0.5% solution. I'll get to the dilutions in a second. And everybody used it, 4 to 5 drops into each nostril 10 minutes prior to the exam. And if they were going to do a endoscopy procedure, they had the patient do nasal douching with the stuff for twice the previous day before they came in. And then they used 10 mLs, that's 2 teaspoons, as a mouthwash if it was going to be a throat exam. And gently gargled for 30 seconds, hold in the mouth for 30 seconds, then gargle and spit. Do not swallow. You really don't want to destroy your microbiome. And that's one of the problems with taking silver internally, is you're going to screw up your bacterial diversity in your gut. So this study did not show any side effects or adverse effects. They did not actually test for virus particles. So they didn't then take swabs of people and try to infect. But we do have data that shows that this would be a sufficient amount. And I think this is really useful. And I am going to, first of all, tell you, I think old iodine is fine. This stuff is really, really stable. And let's talk about the percentage. Now, you have to know what percentage povidone iodine you've got. So I'm going to start with 10%. And for that one's easy, right? For 10%, you'd use 1 milliliter of the iodine in 20 milliliters of sterile water. If you had a 5% solution, well, that's pretty easy. 1 mL in 10 milliliters of water gets you to 0.05. You've just divided it by 10. If you have 7.5, it's going to be 1 mL in 15 mLs of water. And if you have 2.5% povidone iodine, it's going to be 1 ml in 5 mLs of sterile water. So basic fractions, pretty simple. Obviously, if the percentage is higher, you do the math in the same direction and dilute more. I hope that's helpful. And I used my kind of Occam's razor. It looks simple. It looks validated enough for an emergency situation. And it looks harmless enough for an emergency situation. Please do not inject. Please do not swallow. So we're moving to our next email. And this one is from an anonymous anonymous writer in Santa Cruz. I thought we'd better do that one, this one right away. If you use this, please don't use my name, all right? Well, you're anonymous. I'm experiencing urinary tract infection. I went to CVS and bought the strips that determine whether there is high leukocytes and nitrate in my urine. There was. I'm treating it without antibiotics. I'm taking a lot of vitamin C, drinking a lot of water with apple cider vinegar, taking probiotics, cranberry tabs, and oregano oil and water. What is the chance of me treating it successfully? And the repercussions if I'm unsuccessful. The symptoms vary depending on how much water I drink and how diligent I am with the supplements. By the way, I think I got it from using a bidet. Well, that's possible as far as getting it from a bidet. In general, diarrhea is a really great way to get a bladder infection, and so is sex. So you'll have to also consider whether those could be contributing. But regardless of whichever, the female urethra is very short. It doesn't take long for bacteria that gets smeared around the outside to climb up and get in there. There's an old saying that the doctor who treats him or herself has a fool for a patient. I'm just going to share that with you. I do understand your desire to avoid antibiotics and avoid trashing your microbiome. So as far as the stuff that you're doing, I'm not really convinced that the vitamin C is that helpful. The drinking a lot of water with apple cider vinegar is potentially alkalinizing the urine. I know that's backwards, but that's what happens. And so that makes sense. Taking probiotics is kind of like closing the barn door after the horse has left. Cranberry tabs definitely help. Oregano oil would not be my choice of antibacterial. This is a natural antibacterial, but that would not be my first choice. So let's move to what I would suggest in a patient in my office. But before I do that, I just want to talk about those urine strips you mentioned. Now, urine strips are notoriously inaccurate because women have vaginas, and it's very easy for a little vaginal goo to be hanging around in front of the urethra so that when you pee in a cup and then dip the strip, or pee on the strip for that matter, which many people do, the bacteria and the nitrate made by that bacteria may give you a false positive on the urine. So you have to use good technique, clean off well with soap and water, and then clean catch, which means that you don't use the urine that first comes out. You wait till you hear it hit the bowl. And I also want to talk for just a moment about data. Not a lot of data about your regimen or the regimen I'm suggesting that shows superiority. In fact, I would say it's definitely inferior to antibiotics from the standpoint of getting rid of the infection. So you need to be very vigilant about fever, any upper back pain, because if you develop those, you need to start on antibiotics right away. Now, humans, women have been in particular, and men have been getting bladder infections since there were humans, and probably before that, but we weren't humans. Most people survive their urinary tract infection, but it's not fun, and some people do get an infection in the kidney, which can damage the kidney permanently, or they get an infection in the blood, which can put you into septic shock and kill you. And the older you are, the higher your risks for the complications. And you don't give me your age, but if you're over 60, you know, I would really be vigilant. I'm sure you're checking your temperature, but you want to be careful. What I would add, and my preference for trying to treat this, would be Uva ursi, which is a plant called bearberry. It's a very decent urinary tract compound because it gets into the urinary tract in higher concentrations than oregano does, for example. So you get a higher urine level that makes you have a better chance of killing the bacteria. And the other thing that I always recommend, particularly for recurrent infections, and it's similar to the cranberry, is a sugar called D-mannose. Too much of this will give you diarrhea, so I recommend about 500 milligrams twice a day. That's the D-mannose. You can find both of the Uva ursi and the D-mannose at health food stores. These are decent. D-mannose and cranberry have the same mechanism of action. They make the bacteria slippery, so when the bacteria divide, the new bacteria have to grab on, and they can't grab on as easily. So it causes you to be able to flush more of the bacteria out. So I hope that's been helpful. I went into a fair amount of detail because I thought, given the nature of your question, it was probably important to get to it right away. Our next email comes from Victoria in Indianapolis. Subject: wheezing. In early September, I began experiencing, for lack of a better way to describe it, wheezing. I had wheezing many years ago, and this is not the same. The wheezing, and she puts it in quote marks, can occur when sitting and will definitely occur during exercise and seems to me to be coming from the left side of my throat, not my lungs. I called up my nurse practitioner and we had a televisit. She prescribed an inhaler and sent me for an X-ray. The X-ray prompted a visit to the pulmonologist and a CAT scan. The pulmonologist diagnosed a previous histoplasmosis infection and GERD, so I'm guessing that the CAT scan they did was a chest CT because you had a pulmonary nodule and they wanted to make sure that that wasn't looking scary, like cancer scary. And he or she gave you antacids. I am not really sure why. Singulaire, which is one of those, it's actually Montelukast. That's the drug that we were talking about for the leukotriene inhibition. It's one of the drugs that in the email about the mast cell activation syndrome, we were talking about possibly using that as a therapeutic. I had no gastric symptoms, but I stayed on the generic and watched my diet until I had constipation, at which point I had a follow-up in-office appointment with my nurse practitioner who has referred me to an ENT. None of the infections have had any effect on my symptoms. I'm healthy otherwise. She goes on to give her vital statistics. I've stopped all the prescriptions and currently take only vitamin D3. I do not smoke, but I did smoke as a teenager, quit more than 35 years ago, so we're getting a sense that she might be close to her 50s. The only other thing of note is that I have a 10-year-old hip implant, which is serving me well. I want to add that I do have a history of thyroid problems and followed regularly. My recent thorough labs and the CT scan do not suggest any current problems. So the first thing I would say is there are two kinds of high squeaky noises with breathing, and it's important to differentiate them. So a question that you probably didn't get on your televisit was, is the wheezing when you inhale or exhale or both? That's question number one. And then question number two is, if you cough, first of all, are you coughing anything up? And second of all, does it change when you cough, get quieter? And then the third question that you want to ask, I wish that I could ask you, is does it change with your head or neck position? So we were on the phone, I'd say, Victoria, can you hear it now? Great. Bend your head forward. Take a deep breath. Do you hear it now? Bend your head backward. Look up at the ceiling. Take a deep breath. Do you hear it now? Because you said that you think it's coming from your throat. Well, that's pretty near your left ear, and I would expect that you're right. So if it's when you inhale, you have something called stridor. Most of us, if we've raised a baby or know about croup, certainly pediatricians have heard stridor. You'll also hear stridor when a person has something trapped in their airway. So when they breathe in, that peanut or that toy, that Lego, for example, will whistle. And so you'll hear it on the inhale. But on the exhale, you either won't hear it or it'll be much quieter. On the other hand, asthma wheezing is always much worse on the exhale. If you hear it on the inhale at all, you're in very bad shape. And that's an important distinction to be making, and one that can be made at a distance. But, you know, just to be fair, we're all learning our telemedicine, and I have almost 30 years of phone medicine under my belt, so I've picked up a few things over the years. The ENT will indeed take a very careful look in your throat, and also take a very careful feel of your thyroid. You don't mention whether what your thyroid problem was. I'm hoping it's just low thyroid and not a history of thyroid cancer. But a mass in your throat pressing on your trachea could definitely give you stridor, and you would hear it, of course, issuing directionally, which is not typical for people who wheeze. By the time the sound gets up to your ears from your lungs, first of all, most people wheeze bilaterally, and second of all, it's kind of blended in with the atmosphere, so it doesn't generally have a directionality to it. So I think this is upper airway. It may be structural. There are a number of things that are benign, like thyroid cysts, and one or two things that aren't. And the ENT is the right place to go. So you might talk to them about using povidone iodine and find out if they know about that paper, because that sounded really useful. And all they have to do is Google povidone iodine COVID-19 ENT, and they'll find the article with the dilutions. So I hope that's been helpful to you and potentially to a few other people. I'm going to take a break from emails. We have a few more, but I want to, as I promised, talk about that last little bit about evolution and natural selection and the vigilance that we need to have. And you'll notice I haven't said the word vaccine this show, but I warn you, I'm not talking about the COVID vaccine. I'm actually talking about polio vaccine. And why on earth would we need another polio vaccine? Well, there's that natural selection thing that we're talking about rearing its head all over again. So let's go back to the 1950s when polio was a huge problem all over the world. It caused infantile paralysis. It killed lots of children, particularly little ones, and it crippled generations of people, everyone from FDR to my buddy Steve Lengel in medical school, had polio. And polio is a disease of the motor neurons. So it's a little bit like Guillain-Barré. It kills the motor neurons, so you lose the ability to power your muscles. Sometimes it goes all the way up to the neck, and you lose the ability to breathe, hence the iron lung. So this was an ugly, evil, nasty virus, and it was a poop-to-mouth disease. And so it could be spread in swimming pools, swimming holes, nurseries, and a lot of people were asymptomatic carriers and asymptomatic shedders, which made it even more fun, because when people shed, they would shed for a long time. So the medical researcher Albert Sabin developed the polio vaccine by growing the virus in non-human primates and cell cultures. And he just kept growing it in cell cultures until, just like the ferrets, it adapted to its new environment and became very bad at infecting humans. This attenuated virus was used as a vaccine. Remember, this is 1950. And the result is that today, just a few hundred are infected and a much smaller number paralyzed each year because the disease is attenuated. It's not as severe. The vaccine has to be taken by mouth, and the recipients will excrete live virus, just like the natural infection. Other people will get a light dose of the virus. It can get into contaminated drinking water, but what happens is people don't wash their hands. So it spreads through the community, but the attenuated virus, essentially, you give the vaccine to one person, and then a circle of life around them actually gets vaccinated passively. Well, this sounds good. We stopped using this in the United States some time ago because there were a few people every year who would get it, and the people who were immunosuppressed could, in fact, get a bad case. So we went to the injectable vaccine. But the oral vaccine has still been used widely throughout the planet. But what Sabin didn't know, and what we now know, thanks to a virologist at UCSF named Rao Londino, is that this attenuation that Sabin got, it was a single mutation in the virus. And it was just stopping it from being that good at infecting humans. But mutation happens. So probably as early as 1988, there was an outbreak of polio that began in Egypt, and when they looked at it, it appeared to be derived from the vaccine-attenuated virus, which had mutated back to become aggressive again. That did not, however, make any headlines because it wasn't noticed in time. In 2015, wild-type polio was declared to have been eradicated, the secondary cases having thought to be rare, and the World Health Organization withdrew the oral polio vaccine around the world. This happened all over the world in 2016. Yay, polio's gone. So immunity to polio began to wane. But that virus, the new virus that was actually a mutated version of the vaccine, came back. So now the World Health Organization, recognizing that we have an epidemic of this in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and cases are also increasing in a bunch of other countries, 19 African countries, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Yemen. The cases have gone up 400% since 2019. So in 2020, we have another virus to worry about that's not gotten much news press. So what have they done? Well, they've created a new vaccine, and the World Health Organization is set to fast-track this new vaccine. The new vaccine is triple-locked. It has three mutations, and they spent a long time working on it, over a decade now, to try and get it right, because this was, you know, known that it was coming and that we needed a new vaccine. Well, now we've got it, and it's about to be released, and let's hope that it's locked down. But it just goes to illustrate how extremely complicated and difficult it is to get this right, and why we need to be using all the protective measures available to us, all of the science, all of the smart people, and we need to listen to the smart people. And we need to follow the science, even though it's a work in progress, right? We're building the car as we drive it down the road at freeway speed. Okay, let's do another email or two in the time we have left. This one from Ellen in San Francisco. Ellen writes, postural tachycardia syndrome. This is also called POTS, P-O-T-S for short. After two or more years of testing to determine the cause of multiple symptoms, my 29-year-old nephew has been diagnosed with postural tachycardia syndrome, a.k.a. POTS. He recently went through a variety of tests, including the tilt table test. It seems to be a complicated condition, so it would be helpful to hear an explanation of the syndrome and your thoughts about the best treatments. Well, I'm going to start by just taking a moment and talking about autonomic dysfunction syndromes in general. Your autonomic nervous system controls heart rate, breathing rate, you can override it, the breathing rate anyway, digestion, sensation, and body temperature. We can't generally override those. It's a connection between your brain and just about all the body parts. When you see something you like, it's the autonomic nervous system that causes your pupils to dilate slightly. If you are lying, it's your autonomic nervous system that causes you to sweat a little bit, the principle of lie detectors. Subsequently, I think they've been pretty discredited, but still, it is a useful indicator for overall stress. There is a push-pull, a yin-yang, to the autonomic nervous system. For example, we have fight or flight, which is the sympathetic nervous system, and we have rest and digest, which is the parasympathetic nervous system. And it's like you're riding down the road, and you've got the reins of a horse, and you're pulling on the sympathetic syndrome when you need to fight or flight, and the parasympathetic when you need to rest and digest. And this can get messed up. Anything that damages nerves, Parkinson's disease, diabetes, and in younger people, which 29 would qualify him for, viruses are a common cause. It used to be thought it was due to stress, kind of burning out your system, but that's been fairly thoroughly discredited. It's much more common, besides the diseases I've mentioned, in people with autoimmune disease, Lyme disease, rheumatoid arthritis. When we talk about autoimmune disease, and this is something that's become, or is a recent discovery in young people, we're finding antibodies against the adrenaline receptors and the acetylcholine receptors. So it's as if your immune system is attacking the receptors. The signals are still coming from the brain, but they aren't being received. Rather analogous in a way to type 2 diabetes, although the mechanism is an immune attack rather than a burnout. In POTS, what happens is that when a person goes from lying down to standing up, or they stand up for prolonged periods, they get a rapid heartbeat, and they also get a loss of vascular tone. So their heart is speeding up, and their blood vessels are relaxing. That ordinarily doesn't happen at the same time. And they drop their blood pressure and feel faint. Often people manifest as having dizziness and sometimes fainting. But most commonly, the cases I've diagnosed personally have been in people who came in with fatigue. There's probably 3 million people in the United States that are known to have this. And in my opinion, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's probably many, many more. It affects 5 times as many women as men. And it can affect children. It can be associated with connective tissue diseases like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is typically it's the person with the really lax skin, but their blood vessels are lax as well. And about 1 in 4 people with this are disabled. Symptoms can be mild, they can be severe, but essentially what they are suddenly your heart's beating fast and you're feeling really faint. And if you don't lie down, you do faint. And you feel very tired for a day or so after that. The tilt table test being positive indicates that your nephew has a fairly severe case of this. I actually see people who will test negative on a tilt table, and then at another time they'll test positive. So that iron bar that Stanford, the autonomic clinic at Stanford, for example, draws across this diagnosis is bogus. It's a continuum disease. And the question is, what's the normal response? And let's, instead of saying, well, you don't meet the threshold for the disease, let's say you certainly might have the disease. Let's see if you respond to the treatment. Fortunately, there are treatments. One of the problems that people with this disorder have is brain fog. Low blood pressure and fatigue will definitely give you brain fog. And there's data that people will respond to modafinil, which is a drug for narcolepsy. There's also a old, cheap blood pressure medicine called propranolol, which should always be tried first because it's cheap and it comes in a variety of doses. There's a brand new and, of course, very expensive drug called ivabradine, I-V-A-B-R-A-D-I-N-E. But I also found something I think would be extremely useful for you and your nephew, Ellen, and that's vagus nerve stimulators. If you look at the data, there are several very promising uses of vagus nerve stimulators, and we don't have to stick it in the brain like we do for epilepsy. You can actually literally stick it in your ear. Turns out the ear has a direct connection to the vagus nerve, something they taught me in acupuncture school a long time ago, but it's gradually creeping into common knowledge. You can buy direct vagus nerve stimulators. And it makes sense to try these and the drugs that I've mentioned for your nephew. There is a device called the IB-Stim, and I will email you a link to a researcher in the United States who is using that to treat irritable bowel. But I also think it might be useful to stimulate the vagus nerve for your nephew. There's also a device called AcuStim. Also available over the counter. It's marketed for insomnia, raises parasympathetic tone. And if vagus nerve stimulators work, the question is just finding the right frequency. And coming to frequency, it's time for us to let 90.7 FM move on to the next program. This is Dr. Dawn Motika saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.